You're listening to the IQVIA podcast, where we discuss ways to drive innovation in healthcare.
Good morning and welcome to the IQVIA podcast. Specifically today, we're going to speak on the National Health Insurance and the new bill that is in Parliament at present and the new plans for reform in South Africa. I'm Jana Bartels. I'm a senior consultant at IQVIA. I've been working in the healthcare industry for 28 years across public and private sector. Today, we welcome our expert, Dr. Nicholas Crisp. He's our Deputy Director General at the National Health Department. Dr. Crisp is known to all of us for his passion in getting NHI into place and transforming the healthcare in South Africa. I want to really welcome you to the session, Doctor, and I really want to commend you for your passion. Today, we're going to start off with one question. Does South Africa need healthcare reform? And if so, why?
Yeah, thanks very much, Jana, and thanks for involving me in this discussion. We definitely need reform. Our health system is in very serious trouble, both the public and the private sector. And we are on a spiral of decay in the system for different reasons in each of the sectors. So for completeness sake, the public sector is 10 public government departments, each funded separately through different funding streams that people think is one budget, but in fact, it's 10 different budgets. And as a result of that split, there's a lot of duplication that happens in the system. There's a lot of patients who don't get continuity of care because of provincial boundaries and the way in which the budgets work. And there's been a lot of fraud and corruption in the system for a long time now. So collectively, the public sector is in trouble. It is servicing on a regular basis about 85% of the population, and it has a budget of around 5,000 rand per person per year to do that. And that includes all the responsibilities that the state has for international health liaison, border management, port health services, malaria control programs, and the like. So it's a small budget for a large number of people. The private sector's challenges are completely different. It is funded and provided separately. So it's a purchaser-provider split in the private sector. There are currently 71 medical schemes, which cover roughly 9 million people, which is about just under 15% of the population. And so the private financing is largely through that pre-financing mechanism. About 1% of private financing is through insurance as opposed to medical schemes, and about 15% is out-of-pocket payments. And that's growing rapidly because people are migrating their packages down into hospital packages rather than comprehensive packages. And therefore, all their primary health care has to come out of some other kind of gap cover or out-of-pocket payments. The challenge we have in the private sector is that it's become saturated for a long time now. So people are likely to overservice and to trade up, if you like. So what happens is that specialists are seeing patients who could easily be seen by a general practitioner, and general practitioners are seeing work patients with care that could be provided by a nurse. So it's getting more and more expensive because of that shift. And we are also seeing increases in the use of technologies that have not been proven to necessarily be advantageous and have not been tested against any form of health technology assessment. And so it's getting more and more expensive. There are 308 options in the private sector, and that means that an individual, any of these 9 million beneficiaries, must try to anticipate their own health needs for the coming year so that they can insure themselves for the benefits of one of those 308 packages. That is clearly impossible to do. So what's the result of all of this is that the public sector is decaying, and so staff are getting fed up and trying to migrate into the private sector. They're finding it saturated there. There is money in the private sector because it's a supplier-induced demand environment, and so it's a suck factor as well. The bottom line is that the private sector spends more than the public sector, and it translates to about 27,000 rand per person per annum being spent in the private sector. So these two spirals are heading us in a direction of collapse of the health system.
Absolutely feel that from my perspective. You know, I think you hear it every day that out-of-pocket spend for patients are getting more and more in the private sector, and it becomes unaffordable. And I agree that we need to do something to change this continued spiral that we're on. So if you can maybe just enlighten us a little bit as to how the NHI will address the current skills shortages that we have, especially I think from healthcare professionals. We know that we have too few doctors in South Africa to service the total population. And then the second thing is also the demographic spread of our patients. We know that geographically our patients is across the country. We have very limited primary healthcare facilities in the regions where our patients are. So how will the NHI address that?
Okay, so let's separate purchaser and provider, funding and delivery of services. We are currently a complex of purchaser and provider under one through an incremental budget process in the public sector. And in the private sector, we are a purchaser-provider split, as I've explained, in the private sector. What we are trying to achieve is where we get that everybody gets the same set of benefits. So you don't have 308 different options from which you need to choose. There will be one set of benefits, which we will work out what we can include in those benefits based on the money that's available. Now, this is something that's a little bit alien to people most people in the private sector, where you just keep increasing prices if you want to deliver more service. In public sectors, it doesn't work like that. You get a fixed budget, which in our case, let's talk as a country, 8.5% of GDP, and you ask yourself, what can we do with that 8.5% of GDP? Can we provide more medicines, more service coverage, more facilities, more staff, more? What can we do to increase the services? So in the universal healthcare diagrams that one sees, what you're trying to do is get more services to more people at a lower cost to the individual at the point of care. Those are the three dimensions. So the NHI is not going to employ any service provider, none. It's not its job. It is not replacing the National Health Act, and it's not replacing the Medical Schemes Act, and it's not intending to take over the running of any services, public or private. It is the aim is to bring the money into one space so that we are able to get efficiencies. Now, how do you do that? Well, the one efficiency is that, for instance, the public sector, by having 10 government departments, plus the Defence Force, plus correctional services, plus a host of other smaller places or entities that spend money in the public service, every one of those is a duplication of administration, and it pushes the cost up. It also means it's complicated. So people start to try and find ways to get around the system, and that leads to fraud and corruption. In the private sector, we have, as I said, 71 medical schemes. They must all have trustees. They must all have annual general meetings. They must all have their glossy pamphlets. They must each independently try and compete with one another. So they must be constantly reviewing their packages to try and be relevant and to do whatever they think is feasible within what they've got in their, the rates that they can push up their tariffs to their patients. And that duplication of everything, 71 times, plus all the pamphlets and everything, costs about 15%. The administrators alone cost just under 9%. And then, of course, the schemes themselves have an administration. The brokers must be paid to try and advise all of the patients. And at the end of the day, we are spending at least 15% of that $277 billion in the private sector just on administration. Then the practices must adapt their practice management to be able to interface with 71 medical schemes. And because they can't, they then start to get into designated service providers, which is not a good idea for anybody who lives in a rural area. You have to travel long distance to get to one of the designated service providers. And you lose the right to choice because of that. And it's happened. It's a widespread problem in the private sector. So the National Health Insurance world intends that the money, when the money's in one place, the fund will purchase the same price for the same benefit, no matter whether you're a public or a private provider. And what that does is it starts to increase access. Because, for instance, 76% of all the specialists are in the private sector. Now the fund will be able to purchase care for people who previously did not have access to that specialist care from those specialists. The specialists will need to give up some of what they were seeing before of general everyday problems to the general practitioners. And we would like to see the general practitioners back as they were in the past, as the gatekeeper to the system, as the most important part of clinical governance in the primary healthcare space, so that we get more preventive healthcare. They will not be able to do that unless they work with the nurses, the community health workers, optometrists, physios, and all the others who work in the primary healthcare space. So the design of the National Health Insurance intends that at a community level, which we call contracting units for primary healthcare, small subunits of population, we will have a far greater role for general practitioners in coordinating and ensuring that there's preventive care in that space. So what happens in this process, and it's a process, it's not an event, is that we systematically shift patients into the appropriate environment for their care. We know that lots of people who have money are unhappy about this because they think they have a right to see a specialist of their choice. And maybe they do, but they only have that after a general practitioner or somebody else has, a nurse, has determined that that general practitioner or nurse is not able to care for you. We don't have a right to waste resources. We don't have a right to take resources from other people. And the state has an obligation to make sure that the system does not create these perverse incentives and makes it possible that we use everybody that we've invested in, ourselves as practitioners, in a most appropriate way. So it's not necessarily creating more. It's systematically shifting people so that we use them better. Having said that, we currently produce more doctors than we can employ in South Africa. We have at any one time somewhere between 300 and 400 doctors who we can't employ, and that's because there's not enough budget to pay for them in the system. We have a surplus and an increasing number. Everyone giving you the impression that doctors are immigrating in their droves, but the number of doctors who are working in South Africa at the moment are more every year than the previous years. So we are not seeing that massive flight that people talk about. And we actually see quite a large number of doctors immigrating into South Africa because they want to come here. It's a nice, despite us complaining and moaning, it's actually quite a nice country to live in. And for clinicians who are learning, the amount of clinical exposure you get in South Africa is huge. So I don't want to say it's easy and it's nice and everything is fine, because it's not, but we can definitely use the resources we have at the moment far better than we have been using them up till now.
Optimal distribution, I think that's the key word, and getting everybody where they belong. So the distribution will be key. So from that perspective, what do you then see as the biggest challenge getting this done? I mean, getting everybody to agree to do as was the expectation, you know, see the right patient, work in the correct demographic area. How do you see that?
Yeah, look, Jana, change is difficult for people. You get used to a way of doing things. And we got into wherever we are at any point in time, not through massive once-off events, unless it's something like a war or something. You know, it's over time. It's like putting a frog in a pot. If you put boiling water in the pot, the frog jumps out. If you slowly turn up the heat, eventually the frog gets used to that environment, and eventually it'll die. And that's the analogy for the health system at the moment. We're at that point where the temperature is now too hot for the frog to survive. So, but we get comfortable with with the current, with the present. We are used to the perverse incentives. We don't see them as unethical or illegal anymore. We just see them as, well, that's how the system works and that's how everybody behaves. It doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
So the big challenge, I guess, is there are so many vested interests. And as a result of that, each person who has their perspective within their vested interest will provide a perspective. Sometimes it's very deliberate disinformation or misinformation. Sometimes it's just ignorance of how the system works. But a lot of it is protectionism. So I like the way things are now because it works for me now. I believe in universal health coverage, but do it for somebody else. But that's not what the universe means. The universe means one. You know, it's we need to do this together and we need to do it as one. So the single biggest challenge is one to get the facts into the public domain in a way that people can understand. This is complicated. The steps that are required in the reforms are all over. And individuals who have those vested interests will pick up on one clause in a bill. And in the case of the public and the private sector, it's Section 33. In fact, Section 33 is a minor issue for us for the next 5 to 10 years. Section 32 is a far bigger issue. But Sections 12 to 30, which deal with the governance of how we will put the mechanics in place to make sure that this is a sound, well-managed, uncorrupt organization. That's the critical thing. That's the foundation that we need to put in place now. And the bill gives us 3 years to do that. 23, 24, 25, 26, because 23 is almost finished. Those are the years the bill says in the transitional provisions, we must put the administration in place. But people are speaking as if next year your medical aid will be gone and your tax credit will be gone. Your tax credit will be gone at some point because you won't need the tax credit because the fund is paying for your benefits. And people don't see that this is the same money.
Yeah.
It's channeling the money through a different mechanism for payment. It's like the public sector subsidizes its 1.2 million employees to the tune of 75% of their medical scheme contribution. But if that 75% were channeled to the fund instead of to 71 medical schemes, it's still the same money. It's still 70 billion rand. And people can't see. They say, you're going to take away my rights. You're going to take away my money. You're not going to take it away. You're going to move it to a different channel for payment. And instead of those people having access to 71 medical schemes with 308 packages, some of us getting very little because we can't really afford, and others getting everything and feeling I can waste because I'm paying so much. If we are all getting one set of benefits that we can all see, that we can all understand, at this point in time, these are the benefits covered. So I keep being asked, what are the benefits the fund is going to cover? I ask the medical scheme, what is your benefit you're going to cover just one of the 308 packages next year? And they can't tell you. In fact, you don't know until you get sick that you're not covered for that. And they say, oh, but the PMBs, this and this. But people get things that are conditions other than PMBs. What happens to them? Am I covered? Am I not covered? Am I going to pay him and I'm not going to pay in? Imagine if we all know upfront, these are the benefits that we are all going to benefit from. Now I don't need to take my granny and my sister-in-law and my neighbor's medical aid card and go and get them to write scripts for me and all the other fraud that goes on in the private sector. It's not necessary anymore. If I know what I'm being paid as a practitioner and I don't have to get pre-authorization and pre-this and pre-that, imagine how much money I could save to spend on patient care. So that's where we are aiming for, simplifying the system, simplifying the way we pay for that system, and making sure that every provider knows what is how they're going to be paid and what they're expected to do.
Very true. I love reading the news, and the first thing that's always highlighted and put onto the government alone is fraud, waste, and abuse. But you know, just of late, we've seen all the reports of how much fraud, waste, and abuse is in the private sector. So it's not a one-sided thing; it's everywhere. And in saying that, and knowing that there's a lot of opposition, how do you think the private sector specifically can partake more, can be more part of change and the reform and get more involved?
This thing called the private sector is a myth. There's no one private sector. There are segments of a private sector that each do different things. And some of those segments in that private sector are extremely happy and work very well with us in the preparation for the NHI. And there are others whose business models are going to be severely disrupted and are not happy. So you have to segment it. Let's go to, first of all, the funders. So there are medical schemes. Theoretically, these are not-for-profit organizations. They belong to the members. But those who fight to maintain the medical schemes are the employees of the medical schemes, because they have got positions. They are managers and people who get their employment because of the medical scheme. So if the medical scheme is going to become, if they're going to become fewer and they're going to become some of them redundant and so on, some people are going to lose their jobs. So they will fight. That's one player in this space. The second player in the private space is the administrator. So the administrators charge the schemes to administer their transactions and the running of their businesses. That is a commercial business. It's a hugely viable multi-billion rand business. And that's a large part of the 15 billion I was talking about that is consumed in administration goes to administrators. There are relatively few of them because that's just how it is. They administer many schemes. And that's their business model. So they will fight either as collectives or individuals to maintain or sustain at least a portion of what they do now. Then there are the providers. Still in the funders is the brokers. There are thousands of brokers. If you don't need a broker anymore, because there are not 308 options to have explained to you, and I've never found a broker who knows all 308 options. They will know three or four or six, and that's what they sell. So they're salesmen. They're not brokers. We need them, but we need them to do other things, not what they do now. In the NHI space, we need case follow-ups. We need to make sure that people do understand how the benefits, where to access the benefits. So they need to come on board and transform in their minds to play a different role. Then there are the providers, and they are segmented in the private sector. The GPs are very, very different from the specialists. They are less well organized. They have been pretty much sidelined in the private healthcare system because the private healthcare system is about hospitals and about inpatients, and that means specialists and so on. So the GPs have not been able to play the role that we think they should be able to play in this space. So our relationship with GPs and where we would like to see them delivering service and how they should be paid will be different from medical specialists. Even within the specialties, it's different. Pathologists and radiologists are companies. They may have professional specialists running them and signing off on reports and so forth, but they are run as companies. They are different from the other specialties. And then there's the pharma and the medical devices, and they are product salespeople. They provide product. And how we set the prices and how the providers access those products for their patients will be different. So when we talk about the private sector, we need to understand that this is not a homogeneous group of people who are anti-NHI. Each of them has a very different space and a different role to play. Some are going to have to transform dramatically, and others are going to be strengthened in the process, but they're all going to change.
Absolutely. Good to know. I think, and also for the people that's going to listen to us on this podcast, you know, be part of the solution. Don't be part of the problem, because in the end, we all need proper health care. That's what we all strive for. And our patients need to benefit from what we do. So I want to really thank you for joining me today. It's been wonderful talking to you, Dr. Crisp, and really good luck with all the hard work. It's not an easy task.
Thanks very much, Jana, and good luck to you, and have a good day further.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the IQVIA podcast. Learn more about how we help our customers and partners accelerate innovation in healthcare at IQVIA.com.